Now, one of the things that I hope to do here today is to kind of make you think. I know that I will get disagreement, and that has been not my intention. Although I prepared this presentation for this event today, but the concepts that I've used in the last year, and quite frankly, they generate discussion and disagreement, and that's what it's intended to do. I believe that there is a gap in policing, and I'd like to kind of open up my case and see what your thoughts are on it. What I want to do today is I want to kind of go over the state of the profession. And for those of you that are criminologists, I'm going to ask you to forgive me. I'm going to perhaps be a little more basic than you would prefer, but I know that we also have folks here from other disciplines, and I'd like to sort of establish a benchmark, if you will. And if you disagree with some of the things that I'm saying, I encourage you to question those things. I want to get also into talk a little bit about the evolution of policing and understand that this is now where this is a world according to George S. Cone. Okay? So you're welcome to disagree. You're welcome to think I'm crazy. I did have a little wine when I was doing this together, so perhaps some of that can show. But that's the area that I hope that will create some discussion. And then I'm going to go into something that I call value-added policing. It's a concept that has been in private industry. McKinsey Group and many others have talked about this issue for many years. And I think, quite frankly, we're not going to have a choice. I think not only policing, but all public services are going to have to be radically different in the future because there's just not going to be enough money to do business the way we do it today. And then I will conclude. Starting with the state of the profession, I kind of want to have a little discussion about hotspot policing and community policing. Those are arguably the two models that are most prevalent today, or a variation of those two. And there's a lot of discussions as to whether these things actually are mutually exclusive, whether they can work together. And I want to talk a little bit about, as a practitioner, what I believe, what are the things that work and what does not work about these models. Beginning with hotspot policing, what I'd like to do is kind of, for those of you that may not be as familiar with the concept, basically what it is, and I know that the conference had been some discussion about this stuff, but I want to give you a little bit of historical perspective, which some people may disagree, but certainly one version of the history of how this occurred. Policing many years ago, and actually not many years ago, probably about 20, 30 years ago, there was a concept of random patrolling. And many organizations operated on this concept that if you have police officers going all over the place, randomly going through the neighborhoods, they would suppress crime by high visibility and hopefully discouraging people from committing crimes because they never knew when the police was going to be there. And obviously I'm oversimplifying that for those of you that have spent all your life studying this stuff. That kind of moved into a new area where it was the concept of directed patrol. And in fact, LAPD was one of the pioneers in this. Ed Davis and some others started the concept of directed patrol, as well as other cities around the country. And this was one of the attempts to basically try to start having police officers being at the place where crime was occurring, hopefully at the time where it was occurring. Profession kind of went flat for a long time in this part, and then Bill Bratton, about 1994, 1995, moves from New York, well actually he goes from Boston, Bill was in Boston, went to New York Transit, went back to Boston as a commissioner, and then gets hired as a commissioner of the NYPD in the mid-90s, and he had already worked with some people in developing the concept of Comstat, which really was nothing more than starting to look at where crime was occurring, trying to understand the times, sort of the spatial, temporal relationship in crime, and putting cops in a place where the crime was likely to occur because it had been occurring there before, and more importantly, holding police officers and certainly the command staff accountable for reducing crime. And he brought that up to an organization that at the time, quite frankly, was paralyzed and had been paralyzed for many years. And I hope I'm not offending anybody from New York here, but NYPD was not known for being a crime fighter in the 70s, 80s, and certainly the early 90s. And of course, there's a lot of disagreement as to what occurred in New York. And frankly, I'm not really sure that we will ever know fully what occurred in New York. But New York was really quite remarkable. New York was a city that was really falling apart as far as crime was concerned. And something occurred in the 90s. And you know, some people talk, well, you know, there was a lot of new cops that were put on the streets. It occurred throughout the nation. And all those arguments have validity to it, okay? Crime in LA went down significantly in the same period of time. We did not have Comstock. Comstock did not come into LA until about 1998, when Bernard Parks brought in Fast Track, which was really a copy of what was going on in New York. But nevertheless, something very remarkable occurred in New York and has continued to occur for many years. Now, they're starting to have a little bit of a problem now, but I'm not sure that that could be blamed on the policing style. They have been very, very successful in reducing serious crime in the city of New York for about 10 or 11 years. They have done very well. What works in policing, in hotspot policing? I think it really helps if you have a completely unfocused police department, putting people in the place where crime is occurring, hopefully at the right time, works. And I believe that it has been the reason why crime has gone down in many cities, including if you look at LA since Bill Bratton, and certainly the second, third year of Bill Bratton's administration. I think we saw some significant crime reductions. I like to believe, obviously I'm biased, I was there, I was directing it, but we had significant reductions. We had significant reductions in LA, while cities that were neighboring LA with similar populations were not having the same impact. Their crime was going up. So again, I mean, there's probably a lot of academic holes there, and some of you spent all your life looking for holes, and I'm sure you can find them. But the reality is that we had one city with many cities around it. LA, some things were being done differently, and crime went down significantly. I think some of the things that hotspot policing does not do, and quite frankly, why I personally am moving away from the concept and trying to create a hybrid, and you'll see me talk about it a little more, I don't think we really deal with the root causes of crime. Hotspot policing is about firefighting. You're always fighting fires, okay? Now, I know that there have been variations of that, and I am one of those that have taken the concept, not only in LA, but in Mesa, and start trying to dig deeper, you know, starting to peel the onion. But if you really go around the country and you look at the places that are using the concept models and hotspot policing, by and large, it's firefighting, okay? You're having a problem, it surfaces here, let's get out there very quickly, let's suppress it, let's put people in jail, let's put high visibility, whatever we're gonna do, and then that problem abates or gets mitigated, and then another problem surfaces somewhere else because you start displacing crime, because there is a certain level of displacement of crime also, so then you move to the next place. And you're never really addressing what created the crime in that area in the first place. And sometimes, quite frankly, we don't even know why it started or why did it stop. We really have no idea. Then you move into the other model. You move into the community policing model, and you know, this is a model that I think is one of the more problematic. And part of it is because it really has a problem of definition. I think everybody agrees, you know, we can all give us the criminology 101 definition, the community working with police, identifying problems, solving problems, boom, 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 okay? But really, when you get beyond that, there's not really a clear understanding in the profession about what it really means to do community policing. You know, how does it really work? How does it interact? If you talk to the practitioners, especially at the police officer level, but even at the management level, there's really a lot of disagreement. And I know that I'm really going to start getting some folks here to really force are going to come out, but that's good. Okay, that's what I'm here to do today. What works about community policing, however, assuming that we accept at least the basic premise that it's putting the cops and the community or all the stakeholders to identify problems and work together, I think it increases the legitimacy of policing. I really do. And I think when it's done well, you get a lot of support and you get the cops to start being able to take some things that really should be handled by someone else and having someone else do the things that can impact the quality of life and public safety, but really should be handled by someone other than the police officer. So when it's done well, you get that kind of an interaction. I think the problem is that many times it doesn't really work well. And it doesn't work well because now here's a practitioner in me. You bring all the stakeholders in the room and you say, we have a robbery problem in the corner of Walk and Don't Walk, and we have determined that we got poor lighting, schools are letting the kids out too early, the local transit system is bringing the bus and parking it right in the place where we can bring all the kids so they get ripped off by the local gang members. And guess what? The parents are not really taking care of the kids and all that other stuff. And everybody goes hum, 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 and then everybody walks away. And the police are generally held to deal with the problem. If you get lucky, you may get another light bulb. If you get really lucky, you may get the local transit authority to move their bus stop 3 blocks down to another corner, and eventually you displace the crime to that other corner. The school will tell you all the reasons why they can't do anything because they don't have any more resources, and now those kids are coming from dysfunctional families where the parents don't care. And after you have the third or fourth meeting, everybody's gone away, and the cops are again left holding the bag. Now, folks, you may not like that. For some of you that are in academia, that's the reality of community policing today, okay? And it's not only in the U.S. I have traveled around the country. I know we have some Brits here, and you may be a little more advanced than we are, but, you know, I've been there. And when you get down on the ground and you start walking with a cop on the beat, it's about the same thing, okay? So that's what works and what doesn't work. Now, are these models mutually exclusive? And I know that that's another discussion. They don't have to be. I think they are sometimes because as a profession we're becoming bipolar. Our people are totally confused. You talk to the cops on the beat, they really don't know what the heck they're doing. You know, one day we got a new boss, we're doing community policing. The next day comes a crime fighter, we're fighting crime. And then somewhere in between the two, some politicians and community members says you're abusing your authority, you're losing your legitimacy in some parts of the city because you're doing whatever, so you need to be more community policing. So we're going back and forth and going around and around and around. But they don't have to be mutually exclusive. And I can tell you from a personal experience for our concept meetings in LA were actually where you brought the two models together. We would bring the prosecution, we would bring some community members, we brought in a lot of people, we brainstorm how to use people to do different things. I like to tell people an example about some of the things that we did in LA. Without going into the names of the company, because the names are not really important, but we identified a tremendous difference in car thefts in one location as opposed to other locations around LAX. And, you know, we have been dealing with this for years, and for those that are in LAPD, you know, we have LAX as an area. You have a lot of car theft because you have a lot of rent-a-car companies, and the police is a recovery system for most rent-a-car companies. It works well. Well, we have one particular rental car company that really had a tremendous difference from the rest. And we really couldn't figure out why, and I got a little upset because I kept getting the runaround every 4 weeks, and I finally said to the captain, I said, you and your detective go to that place and have them walk you through their business practice. I want to know what it takes to rent a car in this place. And then go to the competitor across the street and do the same thing. And what we found out, and I'm oversimplifying this because obviously there were other factors, but you have two comparable businesses doing about the same amount of business in the same locale. One of them was using a $250 limit debit card, would take a driver's license from Timbuktu, and really wanted to get the iron over the curb because they figured that 30 days later, if the car wasn't coming back, you call the LAPD, you report it stolen, we go pick it up. Every once in a while, we prone the wrong person, we get a lawsuit, that's okay. We're not paying for that. The other company needed a credit card. They wanted $1,000 available credit. They ensured that the driver's license looked like a real driver's license, and they took a thumbprint. And consequently, their thefts were about 50%. Now, we go and talk to the rental car company, the one that is doing business very loosely, and they basically, very nicely, they say, you know, go pound sand. You know, this is the way we do business. You know, this is free enterprise, you know, capitalism, all this stuff. You go out there, we pay our taxes, get away, go away. And we start talking, so well, what do we do? They're not really committing a crime. Now, I'm a lawyer also, so I get a little bit of that anal part of me on the other side. And I start saying, it's got to be something somewhere. And then looking at the business and professions code in California, you have a section, I think it's 17,200, somewhere around that area. And basically talks about taking an unfair business advantage over the competition by doing some things that you shouldn't be doing. Your practices are creating a problem. And it's a civil case, and you can get triple the damages. Now, the question became, you know, for our city attorney, do we even have standing to do this? And, you know, meaning, can we actually be a plaintiff in this litigation? What would the consequences be? So there was a lot of theoretical discussions about that stuff, but I said, well, let's forget about standing all this stuff for now. Let's just say for a moment that we can. Okay? Let's go back to this folks and say, look, you're costing us millions of dollars. Well, not us, you're costing the taxpayers of the city of LA millions of dollars in the last few years. If you continue to do business the way you're doing it, we're going to test the theory in court. We're going to sue you civilly under this section, and we'll see what happens. If you lose, you're going to lose a whole bunch. A whole bunch. If we lose, these guys are on the payroll anyway. We're going to think like a bureaucrat right now. I'm not going to think like a business person. Fixed cost. You know, we got lawyers sitting around here pushing paper anyway, right? Now, don't quote unquote me there. There is a valley of lawyers sitting around, okay? And certainly they could be doing better things. But that was, so they went back to their legal department. They talked, you know, they said, you know what? We don't want to know whether this could work or not. So they altered their business practices in the theft when that particular agency went down. That, you have a hotspot policing and some other community policing involvement there. We brought in the prosecutors, we talked to some other people in the mix, and it was kind of a, you know, a way where you could say, rather than just placing cops in the corner, which wouldn't have done any good here, we started to try to peel the onion and bring other people into the mix, and we brought, you know, certainly we brought the city attorney, but we actually brought some other people that did some research for us and work for us. Okay? So I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. Now here, talking about the state of the profession, one of the things that I think that many people are missing, and certainly my people within the profession, is that I don't know that we're going to be able to hire and maintain the staffing levels proportionally that we do today under the current models. And I'm going to tell you why. There are several problems here. Number one, the funding is becoming increasingly more difficult, and it will only be increasingly more difficult in the future. You have agencies right now that are providing bonuses. Dallas now for a year has been given $10,000 bonuses to somebody who signs up to be a police officer in Dallas. Mayor Villaraigosa just announced recently they were considering somewhere between a $5,000 and a $10,000 bonus to becoming LA cop. Starting July 1, there's a regulation, a new, well, it's something that's been done in the private industry, but basically there's a new set of legislation that will take effect that will impact public services at the local level. And basically what it is it's going to require cities that have a budget of over $100 million, they're going to have to show that they are solvent, that they can, in fact, support the medical benefits and the retirement benefits of future retirees. Going to be a problem. Bill Fujioka, the CIO of the city of LA, was quoted recently saying he was recommending that the city of LA put about $450 million in escrow to start the down payment in this process. Now, how many of you think LA has $450 million to put in escrow? It doesn't. Okay? And then the following year will impact all cities. That by itself is going to be a tremendous pressure. Because you're going to have to move, unless you come up with another creative solution, and by the way, I think they are, but if you can't, you're going to have to move from a system of defined benefits, meaning in public services and certainly in policing, when people retire, regardless of what they pay into the system, there are certain things that are guaranteed they're going to get. They have a guaranteed salary with cost of living increases, they got a guaranteed medical services, regardless of what happens to the economy. Now, most of those in private industry are accustomed to a system that is called defined contribution. You put in a defined amount of dollars in there, but you have no idea what that's going to buy for you 20 or 30 years on the road. The problem in policing is that although I do not believe that people go into a policing thinking about the benefits, and that's an area where the unions and I disagree, young people coming out of college, you know, they're not thinking about 30, 40 years, 20 years on the road. They really aren't. Okay, so I don't think benefits are the driver to get you into the business. But I think when you have been in there for 10 or 12 or 15 years, the investment that you have in the system keeps you there. Because you cannot take it. Even in those places where you can transfer some of the money from your pension, you can't take all the benefits that might be attached to it if you decide to go into another line of work. Okay? Yes, sir.
Maybe same question. This number of 100 million, how is it determined?
How is it determined? It's the budget. It's the general the budget.
Why 100 million, right?
Well, that was the federal government. I think that they wanted to start with the bigger cities, and then they're going to go to the smaller cities. Yeah, that was an arbitrary, well, I shouldn't say arbitrary. That was a number that they came up with. We want to start with the larger cities first, and then we're going to go to smaller cities. But the concern, frankly, is because there are many cities today that are writing checks they're not going to be able to cash tomorrow. And somebody's going to have to pay for this. See? As medical costs continue to escalate and many other costs associated with retirement, as we all continue to live longer, our systems are broke. And what we're doing today, which I personally think is unconscionable, we do it in many ways, is we're really mortgaging our kids' future. You know, we keep borrowing money. We keep printing, you know, local agencies, they keep bonding things. Well, don't worry about it. The next generation will pay for it. Which to me is unconscionable. It really is. But it's getting to the point that even with all the borrowing in the world, you're going to have problems. Because guess what's going to happen July 1 with a lot of these places that are totally underfunded? Your bond rating is going to go to crap. So your ability to borrow is going to decrease significantly. And by the way, there are creative solutions to this, and this is not the place to talk about it, but you know, there are ways to get around that. But that's the reality today. So you have a funding problem, you have an increased demand because populations are growing, and then you have a police applicant pool problem. And I'm not one of those that says that police officers of the past were better than the ones today. In fact, I completely disagree. And that usually upsets a lot of people in the profession, especially people of my age. I personally think that the cops that are getting in the business today are better. They're more educated, they're much more sophisticated than we were, and they have to be. They have to be. And frankly, I also disagree wholeheartedly with the concept that the people of my generation, somehow their backgrounds were better, that we were cleaner, that we used less drugs, that we did less things. All that is a bunch of crap. It really is. Okay? Because the generation before me, I'm not the generation of the 60s, I came a little later, but the generation of the 60s, and those of you that are here, I hope I don't offend you, but you guys used drugs until you dropped. Okay? You screw everything that walked because there were no problems doing it. There was no such a thing as AIDS and all that other stuff. Okay, and then my generation came in the 70s and wasn't much better. You know, we maybe didn't screw as much as you guys did, but we still had, you know. Okay? And how do I know this? I ran the backgrounds unit for LAPD for 2 years during the mid-90s. And not only was that one of the biggest times to hire for the LAPD, because that's when Richard Reardon basically told Willie Williams, if you don't put one part of 10,000 cops in, you understand. And I was dragged from the field because I was the one that actually participated in writing the public safety plan. And basically what I was told, you wrote it, you go and do something. For the last year, we haven't been able to keep up with the hiring demand. And we did. So I was actually involved leading a process that went through something like 15, 16,000 applicants and hiring about 1,300. But also because big agencies are always getting sued, and I had too many times look at backgrounds of people, because now that was my territory, of people that have been hired in the 60s and 70s. And I can tell you that those folks would not have been police officers in the mid-1990s in LAPD. Little things like beating your wife, driving drunk, were not an issue in the 60s and 70s. There weren't even real statutes to deal with beating your wife. I mean, cops used to go in there and say, you know, put your hand on my back, raise your right hand. By the power vested in me, you're divorced for the night. You go, you know, go walk around the block, and everybody left, and then he came back the next day and beat her up again. Right? And we hired those people. Not that we were bad, it was just, I mean, it's a reality. So it's like, if you had real racial problems that would show in your psychological inventory, or if you have problems with gender issues, That was okay. It is more difficult to become a police officer today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. So you have a screening process today that puts a greater demand on the population. You have a growth, and then you have what? What do we tell our young kids in colleges today about lifelong employment? The days of going and working for GM and retiring from GM are gone. What has GM done for the last 15 years? They make people off all the time. Right? There is no lifelong employment in private industry today. In fact, you're told more than likely you're going to have 5, 6, maybe 10 careers in your lifetime. So we start altering the DNA of the labor pool very early on. For a good reason. We want to make them survivors, right? I'm not criticizing that. But what happens in policing when people come up with a DNA? Policing depends on people remaining, at least under the current model, remaining there for a career, 20, 30 years. It takes a long time to be a proficient police officer in the field, and then if you're going to promote through the ranks, and the skills are not always fungible. They're not as fungible as they are in other parts of private industry. So you have an increased demand for people, you have a funding problem, and you have a shrinking labor pool, not only in terms of the coming into the front, but even if you start moving away from defined benefits, you're going to have a problem on the other end, because at 12 years, I don't have any reason to stay here. I can pick up my stuff and I can go to IBM, or I can go do something else. Okay? I think that's going to be a real problem for us. Here's what I think the results are. We have disjointed strategies. We have the bipolarity, if you will, between community policing, hotspot policing, where people don't understand whether they're coming or going, because every day, depending what the flavor of the month is, which is based on people like me, you know, whenever comes in, a new chief comes in, and by the way, chiefs of police in this country last about 2 to 3 years. Okay? We don't stay around a long time. We're a bunch of gypsies. I can include myself on that now because I made that transition. And every time that a new person walks in, what do we have to do? We got to come up with a new and improved, right? So everything that we did for the last 3 years, we shit can it and move on to the next thing, okay? So you have this problem with definitions. You have this problem with the lack of cohesiveness. And then, very seldom do we use meaningful metrics. Many police departments don't even know what the word metrics is. But then the ones that do, basically what do? We use mean-based metrics. What is the average of something, you know? Average number of robberies indicates in the corner walk and don't walk, we got a robbery problem, so we're going to go there. We never bothered to take it to the next level, generally speaking. And again, I know there's always exceptions. Start looking at our lives. Are averages really telling us anything? Or are they leading us to go someplace that we shouldn't be there in the first place? And then we do volume without sometimes looking at risk. You know, the Greek theater is more likely to have fights when they have concerts than Joe's bar several blocks away. But the question is not the number of fights, but it's where am I most likely if I walk into that establishment to get hurt? Is it the Greek theater or the bar? But the concept of risk management is really in times of crime is, again, generally speaking, is really foreign. It's also, we are in a profession that is very crisis driven. And that's where hotspot policing really comes up. It's, you know, it's the last crisis, whether it's generated by crime or whether it's generated by some political stuff. We were just talking, George and I were talking earlier, and Jeff, about MS-13. And I wrote an article that was published in the Washington Post earlier last year that upset Director Mueller and Congressman Wolf, that we were advancing, well, actually, we announced we were going to go to war as a nation against MS-13. And I looked at it and I said, really? Why? Well, they're very violent. And, you know, we had this little girl in Virginia that got murdered in a place where kids don't get murdered by gangs. And, of course, that was Wolf. District. And the killing was very sad. You know, no one should die, but really what we had a young girl that was was associated with the gangs. She became a police informant. She got killed. It's not a good thing, but police informants get killed in every city. Okay? And I can tell you, here in the cradle of MS-13, LA, they have not accounted for most of the murders every year. And that's assuming that you make them look like a single gang, which they're not, by the way. We don't go out and franchise and decide that, you know, we have to answer to headquarters and say, I want to put a new franchise of MS-13 on the block and walk on the walk. We just get three or four idiots, we decide we're from Central America, we're MS-13. Okay? That's the way it really happens in gangs, folks. Okay? There's not this great organized stuff. Now, we are creating an organization because we're deporting people without really paying attention to the consequences, and we're dumping them in a place where the local structure is unable to deal with the problem, and they are unifying El Salvador. And frankly, they're actually creating a situation where maybe a democracy in Central America may not survive because what we're doing. And you also have to realize that those gang members, even though they may have been born in El Salvador, we created them here. They're inner city gang members, American style. Okay? They came here when they were 7, 8 years old, 10, 12. They became a gang member here. And I don't want to take blame for it, but I mean, it's just the social conditions here. And then we take them when they're 18, 19, 20, 22, 23, 24. We deport them over there, we throw the ball down their way. They start getting to know each other there, and then they eventually come back here. Now they do have the networks. But you look at, if you want to look at gangs, and again, not that I believe there's this big gang in the sky, but if you wanted to talk about one particular gang that probably accounts for more murders in the city of LA, it's 18th Street. Now, not because they're meaner and badder than MS-13, it's simply their feeder pool is larger. They come from Mexico primarily, whereas MS-13 comes from Central America. Geographically speaking, we know which countries have more people. So we're crisis-driven, and then consequently, we have very mixed outcomes. I think some of the things that we need to have in the profession, and I think this is the area where many of you could be very helpful in working in partnerships with us, is we really need to analyze all the ingredients in the stew here. We got to look at funding. And yes, for those of you in the criminology side of the house, we really have to start getting together with the folks on the financial side of the house. Because we got to start developing models that we can afford. Okay? We cannot afford the models that we have today. And then we have to start determining what policing, what would the mission be? What would the strategies be? We need that desperately today as a profession. And this is where I think the other side of the house that is here today, and what Jeff and I were talking about a year and a half ago, where I think there's really an ample marriage here. And I believe that we need new algorithms. If we're going to be smarter about policing because we're going to have less people and the problem is not going to be any less, we need to start coming up with solutions so that we can put people to do the right things at the right time. And notice that I'm saying the right things at the right time. I moved away from saying putting people in the right spot at the right time, because it comes back too much to hotspot policing. That's not what I'm talking about. We need to be able, with a greater degree of accuracy, to determine what are the likely events, and not only at the national level, because I know at the national level, and I have been beat up by some of you in the past, maybe not anyone in this room, but I have been beat up before. Well, you can predict crime on the national level, you can predict crime in very large pieces of real estate, but it's very difficult to predict crime at the neighborhood level. It is today, but I'm not sure that has to be the case tomorrow. Because I think that there are solutions out there that are right there. We just don't see them yet. Okay? And we certainly have the technological capacity today to deal with tons and tons of information very, very quickly that we did not have 10 years ago. So there are other people and other disciplines that are giving us the tools that we could take to throw a lot of information and start making sense of that information. But I truly believe that we need to create new solutions, and I think all of the solutions would be mathematically based. Now, the mathematicians cannot do it without the practitioners or those of you that have been studying the business for years, because we understand from different walks what needs to go into the formulas. but we need to work together. I think also, as we start moving in this direction, we will address the funding implications for policing, and we will increase police legitimacy in the long end, in the long run. And this is an area that I want to talk about a little bit, and it's going to value-added policing. And what am I talking about? And basically what I'm talking about here is coming up with a policing model that takes what is good from community policing, which there are a lot of things that are good conceptually, takes what is good from hotspot policing, and there are some things that really work well, and then goes beyond that and starts looking at how do we use the resources so that we can apply them to the right questions at the right time with the right answers. In LA, approximately 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, I talked to a friend of mine who was a professor at Cal State Fullerton, and he teaches graduate work there. And I said, you know, it'd be really interesting. We have our cops fill in what we call a daily field activity report. They account for every minute, and I don't know what it is now with the different shifts that we have, but it used to be it's 525 minutes you have to account for, and you make sure that at the end of the day the three boxes all add up. If not, and of course we're mathematically challenged, so sometimes we spend 20 minutes trying to make sure that the 525 came together. But basically you fill all the boxes and make sure that, you know, we accounted for time, and you know, we obviously stopped and had coffee and did other things, but you know, we took that burglary call, we stretched it about 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there. So we have this kind of creative work, and you know, and I'm not putting down officers for doing it. This is reality of human beings, okay? If any of you think your people that work for you are always giving you 100% of the time, then you're in another world. It doesn't happen for any of us, okay? I mean, human beings have to socialize, we have to think, we got to do other things. But the problem is that the basis that we have, the benchmark for saying what we do during the day, it was really probably very inaccurate. So what I suggested is, can we make a project where you develop a statistically sound basis to do job shadowing for however long it takes, however many times. And you know, I went to law school because I really have a problem with math, and I'm not kidding, I really do, okay? But you figure out what it's gonna take, and let's do, you know, I'll give you the ability to have your people sit in the black, in the backseat of a black and white for the entire shift, and you have your people track what they do. And then let's figure out what they really do. We did that for 1,200 shifts during a year period, okay? Now, I have to tell you, kind of sidetrack here for a second, because it's important why I did this. I have read some stuff before where HMOs, looking at what medical doctors do, they determine, and I don't know what the parameters were, but they determine in HMO's mind, which is kind of scary, but whatever it meant, that medical doctors have spent only about 30 to 35% of the time was value added time. Everything else was something other than fixing people, okay? So that kind of gave me the idea that, well, cops gotta be at least somewhere in the same area. You know, we're human beings, we do the same things. By the way, similar studies have been done on lawyers too. I don't know what the answer to that was. So we did this, okay? And we found out that we took Central Division and LAPD. And we took Central because it was very conceptualized, you know, they had their own uniqueness, but, you know, we thought it was good enough to take a look at it. And we found out that basically somewhere between 50 and 55% of the time, police officers were not doing value out of time. We kind of define value out of time arbitrarily as meaning either reducing crime or working with the community, doing things that we felt would have an impact on crime. They were spending a lot of time writing reports, they were standing a lot of time in the jail cage, booking somebody. There was a lot of time, obviously, doing what human beings do, socializing, all that stuff, but about half of the time was not applying to dealing with reducing crime or the fear of crime, okay? Now, you think for a moment. Typically, in the police department, somewhere around 40% of your budget is going to go to patrolling, okay? So you take LAPD, and I'm going to use, not, again, because I have a problem with math, I'm going to take the numbers of a couple of years ago, about $1 billion budget, okay? Take 40% of that, about $400 million, and then figure about half of the time is not really fighting crime or providing for public safety in some way. And it could be done with any other parts of the business. I'm not slanting LAPD. I'm at a place today that is probably lower than that, okay? It's not the people, by the way, it's the systems that are a problem. I don't want anybody to leave this room thinking that LA cops are lazy or they're not. Absolutely not. They're working their butts off. We got them spinning the wheels all day long. They're spinning the wheels. They're not, 50% of the time, they're not having coffee in Starbucks. They're working. It's just the work that they're doing, it's not really going towards the mission. And the mission hasn't been clearly defined. So I think that beyond hotspot policing and community policing, there has to be this other formula that's got to come in. And this is where I think, first of all, we have to really identify what we do. And then we have to identify if that's what we want to continue to do. And then we have to figure out how do we do it better and how do we apply most of our time and resources to the things that we really want to do. And that's not occurring today. Okay? Now, why now? You know, I think financially we can't afford not to. And by the way, the things that I'm telling you about the numbers in this, you're welcome to do a little research on your own. You will be scared. We could go on for days talking about the problems of funding for public safety in the future. In summary, I think that we don't have an option. I think we really have to move into a new paradigm. And I hate to use the word paradigm because, you know, everybody uses it when we want to feel like we're a little smarter or something. But I really can't figure out another word this morning. So, you know, we need to shift to another paradigm, okay? The challenges are going to be, what are those paradigms? How do we develop them? How do we work together? On the other hand, I think the opportunities are tremendous. I think we have an opportunity to do great things in policing. I think we not only have the opportunity, I think we have a moral obligation to do so, and we're talking about getting the lights. We're not talking about how many cars you put over the curb, how many computers you sell. We're talking about people, and we're talking about people dying, people getting hurt, young people going to prison because assistance failed them. That's what we're talking about. So there are great opportunities here.